Robert Crawford, Scottish poet, has joked that getting Australian poetry books into shops in this country is like trying to get a direct Qantas flight into Auchtermuchty. Well, in that case, just off the afternoon Qantas flight into Humberside Airport to read for us today, then, is distinguished Australian poet Robert Gray. Robert has worked as a journalist, editor, and anthologist, and is the author of more than a dozen books of poetry and several selected poems, including Grass Script, published by Carcanet in this country, through which I first got to know your work. Now, Paul Muldoon has joked about Helen Vendor's dismissive attitude to his own work that maybe there's only enough room in her head for one Irish poet at any given time. And there may be an element of that in our attitudes towards Australian poetry in this hemisphere. So, I think for this reason, it's impossible to read an early poem of yours, Robert, The Sawmill Shacks, without thinking of the great Les Murray's Driving Through Sawmill Towns. And while both men write out of shared landscapes, Robert here is from Coffs Harbour on the north New South Wales coast, just north of Murray's hometown, think of Nabeaq.
We divide the coastline between us.
Ah. While there are all these similarities, fascinating though they be, nevertheless, Robert is a very different writer from the Murray that we know and cherish. This is a writer who understands Robert Frost's need of being versed in country things, but who brings to his vein of Australian pastoral a strong Asian and even Buddhist influence. There are precedents for this in Australian poetry, such as Harold Stewart, best known as one half of Ern Malley, that imaginary spoof Australian poet, who spent many years in Japan. But Robert excels at Asian-influenced short forms and can thread a one-word-a-line poem down the page with all the skill and care, I think, of a spider building a web. Peter Goldsworthy has said of your work that I know of no other poet writing in English who gets anywhere near Gray's power with images, but Robert Gray is also a writer who thinks and argues in words. No less than Robert Creeley or Gary Snyder, this is someone who excavates the brilliant topsoil of his images to get at what deep down lies beneath, or what rather perhaps doesn't, as these lines from Dharma Vehicle suggest. One thing disappears and determines what is arising, and there is no unchanging substance through all of this, nothing to call permanent, only change. That which is the substance of things abides as nothing and is nowhere a nature of its own. Its essential nature is nothingness. Now, among the many residencies that Robert has held in Australia is one at Geelong College, which I mention on this occasion, only to repeat a story I heard there from someone I'm sure you know, Chris Wallace Crabb, who told me that a white man pointed at something with his finger and said to an Aboriginal, "What is that?" To which the Aboriginal replied, "Geelong," meaning the word for finger in his language. Perhaps during your residency you found out whether that's true or not. You can tell me afterwards. But in the meantime, to conclude, Robert's other many awards include the Patrick White Award, the Victorian Premier's Literary Award, and the Age Book of the Year Award. He has also published a memoir, The Land I Came Through Last. I didn't notice whether you have copies of your books to sell with you afterwards. I very much hope you do. I will buy one. You don't?
I can't carry that.
Okay. He doesn't. Sorry about that. Well, just go and buy them on Amazon instead. But anyway, it is an enormous pleasure and privilege to have this most distinguished Australian poet with us this evening. So, over to you, Robert.
Every second Australian is called Bruce. And every second Australian surname is an Irish one. Our form of Smith is Kelly. I had no idea what I would read, but I thought, since we spoke of the David spoke of the Oriental influence, I'd read a Chinese poem. This is often taken for a translation, but it's actually original, although all the details are accurate. The Chinese poet himself is entirely imaginary. The life of a Chinese poet. In his youth, as he recalled, the great causeway of the heavens and earth trembled, and the stars were spilled like dust at the overthrow of a dynasty. It could seem that he was old from birth, he was always saying goodbye. During 90 years, he wrote 5,000 poems in a rhyming prose or a songs for the lute. Otherwise, his life was uneventful, except for the always remembered love that he had for a certain courtesan. His mother refused to let him marry this girl, who was called Scented Jade, and soon afterwards he was ordered as a minor clerk to the far province of Fujian. There he discovered at times the constellation of nature, its vividness, and its unthinkable reality. He writes of the wild mountains that were as sharp and glittering as dog's teeth, and that could be seen from among the hanging flowers of the white lanes. The river there he also admired, which he says was like the great dragon of Qi that turned upon itself in all the 12 directions while subduing the 5 elements. It was his dream from youth to take arms against the Golden Tartars, but the northern frontiers had been made safe. There was no fighting, but only an endless boredom there. At 54, he went home to his native village, having never gained a preferment, distressed by what he heard of the luxury and incontinence of the court. He dreamed in his work of the vast smoke of chariots as they raced upon the plains. He described his travels to far outposts by night on a river that was held within the moon's white stare. Though he styled himself the hermit of the mossy grove and said that he was wild, irascible, and drunken, it seems he longed for the company of other poets. He had married a local girl when she was 15 and spent most of his time quietly lost in his books. Pondering both the Taoist and Chan Buddhist teachings, he grew more and more enamored of nature and found his companionship in mountains, flowers, and trees. In rainy weather, he would put aside his studies and trudge to the inn to drink with the farming hands. Daily, the town inn sells 1,000 gallons of wine. The people are happy. Why should I alone be sad? He was utterly sincere in his love of beauty. The thing he has seen appears on the white paper. There is a sense of overbrimming life. A Chinese critic has said, his poetry has the simplicity of daily speech. In its simplicity there is depth, and in its poignance there is tranquility. When he was 71, the Mongols arose once more and began to attack the celestial horde. The armies of the Sung were continually defeated and were even driven out of Sichuan. Again he applied for enlistment, but amidst the turmoil in the corridors at the provincial capital, he was pushed aside and ignored. Giving up all hope that before he died he would see himself in battle, he returned to his village in disgust. His songs were now being sung by the muleteers in far mountain passes, by girls bringing silk to be washed in the streams. In the capital, they were exclaimed over at wine parties and were murmured beside the imperial lake. He was revered, if rarely seen, in his village, but finally, one morning, the word went around that he had fallen hopelessly ill. Everything was made ready, the thin coffin, the 2 thick quilts, and the payment for the monks. The earth was thrown out of his grave onto the hillside, and the incense was bought that would smoulder among the graveposts there. But then the next day he rose on his couch and called for wine to be brought him from the marketplace. He had the blind rolled up on his view to the south, and he wrote some impeccable verses in the tonally regular 7-syllable form. I read someone commented that someone quoted Hokusai, the great Japanese artist, who said that he was an old man mad about drawing, which gave me the idea of writing this poem. I wanted to write about an old man mad about writing, hoping to become such a thing myself. And it seemed to me that there would obviously be a Chinese poet who would be an old man mad about writing. All tragedians want to write comedy, and all comedians want to be, according to Woody Allen, want to be comics. I've only written one humorous poem. I thought we might get it over with now. It's very brief. It was written for it's my best known poem. It's very brief. It's a limerick written for a competition. The town of Sale is in Victoria. The barmaid in a pub, a barmaid in the pub up at Sale, tattooed her breasts with the prices of ale, while on her behind, for the sake of the blind, she had the same list again in Braille. It didn't win. This is another Chinese influence poem. I noticed in an encyclopedia that the Chinese make lists, an old Chinese encyclopedia, that the Chinese make lists which seem to us entirely irrational. They write about the 12 things that are disgusting to see or some such thing, and they're absolutely anomalous as a list. I've written a list. It's a poem called Classifying the Animals. There are those that in the distance seem a swarm of gnats, those that with their barking try to rally us in a campaign against the stars, those that torment their prey, those that follow both sides of an argument, those that have broken a precious vase, those that can only be painted with a one-head brush, those whose tongues light candles on the fingers of our hands, those that curl their tails, those that refute the argument from design, such as bedbugs and liver fluke, stupid ones who lie still for a while and then run, those whose being is clenched as though it were a knot in a frozen rope, those who are bored, the good-natured beetles, those such as frogs and snails that are enlightened beings, humans born unable to stand, those that are fit to be emblazoned on a flag, mosquitoes, crocodiles, those that should exist, unicorns and mermaids, unacceptable ones unless we can make a great rational effort, those that cause people to smile, ladybirds, etc., those that stir in us an erotic feeling, those that are easily broken and yet their kind continues to exist, those that one would like to be, the centaur, the phoenix. And I'll read one last poem. This poem was very controversial in Australia. It's about my mother's Alzheimer's disease, but it has what people thought irreverent and tasteless remarks in it because it treats the situation at times with some humour. However, I think things have settled down now at home, and I'm sure that you won't let on that I've read it again in public. It's called In Departing Light. It's written in free verse with long fluctuating lines because the emotions, as you would expect in such a situation, fluctuate. In Departing Light. My mother, all of 90, has to be tied up to her wheelchair, but still she leans far out of it sideways. She juts there brokenly, able to cut with the sight of her someone who is close. She is hung like her hanging mouth in the dignity of her bleariness and says that she is perfectly all right. It's impossible to get her to complain or to register anything for longer than a moment. She has made Stephen Hawking look healthy. It's as though she's being sucked out of existence sideways through a porthole and we've got hold of her feet. She's very calm. If you live long enough, it isn't death you fear, but what life can still do. And she appears to know this somewhere, even if there's no hope she could speak of it. Yet she is so remote, you think of an immortal, a Tithonus withering forever on the edge of life, although with never a moment's grievance. Taken out to air, my mother seems in a motorcycle race, she, the sidecar passenger, who keeps the machine on the road, trying to lie far over beyond the wheel. Seriously concentrated, she gazes ahead towards the line as we go creeping around and around through the thick syrups of a garden behind the nursing home. Her mouth is full of chaos. My mother revolves her loose dentures like marbles ground upon each other or idly clatters them, broken and chipped. Since they won't stay on her gums, she spits them free with a sudden blurting cough that seems to have stamped out of her an ultimate breath. Her teeth fly into her lap or onto the grass, breaking the hawsers of spittle. What we see in such age is for us the premature dissolution of a body that slips off the bones and back to protoplasm before it can be decently hidden away. And it's as though the synapses were almost all of them broken between her brain cells, and now they waver about feebly on the draft of my voice and connect at random and wrongly, and she has become a surrealist poet. How is the sun on your back, I ask. The sun is mechanical, she tells me, matter of fact. Wait a moment, I think. Is she becoming profound? From nowhere, she says, the lake gets dusty. There is no lake here or in her past. You'll have to dust the lake. It could be that she is, but then she says, the little boy in the star is food. Or perhaps the little boy is the star in food. And you think, more likely, this appeals to my kind of superstition, the sleepless, inspiring homunculus. It is all a tangle, an interpretation, a hearing amiss, all just the slipperiness of her descent. We sit and listen to the birdsong, which is like wandering lines of wet paint. It is like an abstract expressionist at work, his flourishes and then the touches barely there, and is going on all over the stretched sky. If I read aloud, skimmingly from the newspaper, she immediately falls asleep. I stroke her face and she wakes, and looking at me intently, she says something like, that was a nice parcel. In our sitting about, she has also said, relevant of nothing, the desert is a tongue. A red tongue? That's right, it's a long motor car. When I told her I might be in Cambridge for a time, she told me, Cambridge is a very old seat of learning, be sure, but it became too much. Be sure of the short Christmas flowers. I get dizzy, nauseous, when I try to think about what is happening inside her head. I keep her out there for hours, propping her straight as she dozes and drifts into waking, away from the stench and the screams of the ward. The worst of all this to me is that despite such talk, now is the most peace I've known her to have. She reminisces momentarily, thinking I'm one of her long-dead brothers. Didn't we have some fun on those horses when we were kids, she'll say, giving her thigh a little slap. Alzheimer's is nirvana in her case. She never mentions anything of what troubled her adult years. God, the evil passages of the Bible, her own mother's long, hard dying, my father, nothing at all of my father, and nothing of her obsession with religion that he drove her to. She says the magpie song that goes on and on, like an Irishman wheedling to himself, which I have turned her chair towards, reminds her of a cup, a broken cup. I think that the chaos in her mind is bearable to her because it is revolving so slowly, slowly as dust motes in an empty room. The soul has long been defeated and is all but gone. She's only productive now of bristles on the chin, of an odour like old newspapers on a damp concrete floor, of garbled mutterings, of some crackling memories, and of a warmth that was always there, the marsupial devotion, of a warmth that is just in the eyes these days, particularly when I hold her and rock her for a while as I lift her back to bed, a folded package such as I have seen from photographs was made of the Iceman. She says, I like it when you, I say to her, my brown-eyed girl, although she doesn't remember the record or me come home that time, I sing it to her, sha-la-la, la-la-la-la, and it's you. She smiles up into my face. It's you, my brown-eyed girl. My mother will get lost on the roads after death, too lonely a figure to bear thinking of, as she did once, one time at least, in the new department store of our town, discovered hesitant among the aisles, turning around and around, becoming a still place, looking too kind to reject even a wrong direction outrightly. And she caught my eye watching her and knew I'd laugh and grinned. Or else, since many another spirit will be arriving over there, whatever those are, and all of them clamorous as seabirds along the walls of death, she will be pushed aside easily again. There are hierarchies in heaven, we remember, and we know of its bungled schemes. Even if the last shall be first, as we have been told, she could not be first. It would not be her. But why become so fearful? This is all of your mother in your arms, she who now a moment after your game has gone, who is confused and would like to ask why she is hanging here. No, she will be safe. She will be safe in the dry mouth of this red earth, in the place she has always been. She who hasn't survived living, how can we dream that she will survive her death? Thank you.